No, I was broke. Broke. Yeah, yeah. Like, I didn't have hot water. My hot water was getting turned off. My cell phone would get turned off. Yeah. I didn't have a car. Yeah. I was, like, scrounging through the couch for change to eat Taco Bell. That was my life.
Hello, all, and welcome to Marsha, 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 the podcast. I'm your host, Marsha Molinari, and you are here listening to the podcast that brings true and heartfelt human connection. I believe if you don't know about it, you can't care about it. And that's why we're here today. Yeah. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Today, we have a very special guest and a longtime friend of mine and a friend of the whole group family. It's Bonnie McKee, singer-songwriter, actress, director, writer. I mean, the list goes on and on, Bonnie. She is known for writing number one hits like Roar, Friday Nights, California Girls, Teenage Dream, and many, many more, working with artists like Katy Perry, Jason Derulo, Christina Aguilera, and the wonderful Britney Spears, and on and on and on. She recently directed, wrote, and starred in a short film called April Kills the Vibe, which I just watched. And, you know, this goes along a little bit with something that we were talking about. You watched recently my interview with Rick Caruso, mm-hmm. and just the effects of entertainment media and like what that like can do for you, mm-hmm. and you know, it made you feel a different type of way.
Yeah.
And when I watched your film, I was definitely connecting with friends, myself, our lives that we've had. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had such a great history and many memories here in this town of Hollywood. And let's talk a little bit about that. Well, I want to first talk about where you were born and how you started and kind of like where this spark. I think it's a special thing that when people want to be an actress, they want to be in the entertainment industry. And I think it takes a very special person to kind of like go for that dream.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was born in Northern California in Vacaville, California. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Forgot about that.
Yes.
So my godmother is from Vacaville, and I spent so much time there.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you said you were born there and left maybe shortly after.
I was there until I was about 8 years old.
Okay. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time there. I mean, but like, I think the big thing there's a big prison.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But, you know, whatever with that.
We got prison. We got outlet malls.
Yeah, so, outlet malls. Know.
Something for everyone. Yeah.
I mean, and it's just close enough to the city. I'm not sure if you ever went to the city from Vacaville, mm-hmm. but it is beautiful up there. And I have like, I went all over, you know, from Oakland to San Francisco, down to Central California. Mm-hmm. And so I moved around a lot. So now it takes you to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So my father was in the Air Force, and we actually lived in England when I was very small. We moved to England when I was like 6 months old and lived there till I was three. So when I first learned to speak, I would say, "Mummy, can I have a sweetie?"
I still do
that. And then, moved back to California, and then my dad retired in Seattle. And those were kind of my formative years were spent in Seattle. And it was quite a shock, honestly, growing up in California and running around barefoot with tan lines, you know.
Yeah.
And then moving up to Seattle where it was just the sun never came out. It was a shock. So I kind of immediately went into a depression and did not come out of that until I moved back to LA. My whole childhood I spent just like drawing pictures of what I thought. I'd always thought that the city skyline was like on the beach.
Yeah.
Like I had Miami in my head, I think.
Right.
And so the minute that I could get back to California, I left. Yeah.
And was that 16?
Yes. Yeah.
How did that come about? I mean, that's so young. I mean, 16, I was just still not even thinking about anything like that.
Well, I was, you know, I was a troubled teen. I was getting into a lot of trouble. I got kicked out of high school in ninth grade.
Yeah.
And then I went to an alternative school for a year, and there was really nothing there for me. My parents were in the middle of a divorce, and I was making their lives miserable, and they were making mine miserable. So I was like,
I'm out of here.
I'm leaving. Yeah. I made a demo of original songs, and I gave that to everyone I knew. And then someone that I knew babysat for someone that knew someone in LA. It was like one of those old school things. And they called me and flew me down to LA, and I got an attorney, and my demo ended up getting played on Mornings Eclectic, which is a radio show that kind of industry people listen to. And And I ended up getting a huge record deal. And so, you know, my parents were like, well, like, you've got money, so I guess you'll be okay. Like, bye.
Wow.
And so I left.
I mean, I guess that kind of makes you grow up really fast. I mean, and it happens that way as well, because, I mean, my parents weren't always around. And I've talked about this before. It's like you kind of learn, like, if you're going to get something, you kind of either do it yourself or you kind of fall into the system, you know, and it's either you're going to survive and know that there's going to be a struggle and just hit it because that's all you got. And you just go. So what were those like first years of having, I'm sure, tons of adults around you?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I didn't have any peers my age. I was really lonely. And
were you emancipated at this point?
Yeah. Wow. I was really lonely. I didn't know any other artists. I didn't co-write at that time. I wrote everything myself. So it was a lonely process. I was working with older producers and yeah, I didn't really have any friends other than my manager's kids. But like all my peers were in school. They were in high school still. Yeah. And I was just like had my own apartment in Hollywood and was just like cool and like sitting around just getting stoned all day. And it was lonely. It was definitely lonely.
I mean, was there a cool factor you remember being like, probably like maybe like the first day and then you're like, wait, I'm alone.
When I first came down, I was living at a hotel right here on Sunset Strip, actually. And that was pretty cool because it was on someone else's tab. And so I was like ordering room service and da da da. And so I remember driving down Sunset Boulevard and being so starstruck and just being like, wow, I just can't believe it. And I don't know. That was about the extent of it, though. And then it was like reality hit, and I was like, I don't have any friends. I don't know anybody. I'm just kind of doing my thing. But I was really living in the fantasy of my big dreams.
Yeah.
And like I had made it, and I was really grateful, and I thought all of my problems were over because I had a lot of problems in Seattle.
Yeah.
I was a drug addict. I got really involved in the rave scene, actually, at a young age. And
so it's like ecstasy.
Oh, and yeah. Like hard drugs. And then I ended up getting into meth.
Wow.
So I was ready to leave Seattle and it felt like an upgrade for sure. But then, yes, exactly. Yeah. But then it kind of came with its own set of problems.
Wow.
Yeah.
That makes you like grow up so quickly. I mean, even from being introduced to drugs, luckily for me, I mean, it definitely went that way for a lot of kids in school. And I don't know. I think it's a blessing that I was guarded from that somehow, in some way, because obviously I could have easily been influenced any which way by the surroundings, like just like you. And I just know that just kind of like really makes you grow up so quickly. So you're in now Hollywood. The glam and the shine kind of does go away quite fast.
Pretty quick.
Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, you're just like here. I remember as well walking down Hollywood Boulevard and seeing the stars. And seeing that it's kind of like a little dirty as well, like not what it looks like in the movies or TV shows. Yeah. And I was like, scared. I want to run. So you're here and you're recording and working. When do you feel like you're starting to make progress? Like,
well, they flew me out to New York when I was like 18, I guess, to record the album. So it took forever to like find the right producer. And like, I had no idea what the timeline on these things were.
Yeah,
I didn't even know what a producer was. Yeah. I didn't know the difference between a producer and a mixer and you know.
Yeah.
And so they flew me out to New York and I recorded an entire album there. So I was there for almost a year. Again, living by myself. And I had like a beautiful, amazing penthouse in Tribeca or whatever, or Battery Park City.
My favorite.
And it was actually right after 9/11. It was February after 9/11.
Wow.
And they were like, oh, someone at the label is going to sublet their apartment. And I was like, perfect. So I moved out there and it was right next to Ground Zero. Like it was still smoking. And so I was like, I see why you left.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
So I lived in New York by myself.
I got this great deal.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
And I had one friend who was my hairdresser. And
we love our hairdressers.
Yes, very important.
Yeah.
And I had another kind of lonely stint in New York. And then I came back to Los Angeles and re-recorded the whole album. It was just like, I had no idea how anything worked. And honestly, my manager at the time didn't either. Yeah. So I was just kind of doing what everybody told me to do and not really understanding how anything worked still.
Right.
And now, you know, when I work with younger artists and they come in and they're like, I don't know the difference between a verse and a chorus and whatever. I'm like, I'm so glad that I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you get to come into a room and have someone to teach you.
You have someone like me who once was like you, and now I'm going to fast track you because I knew nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I often tell like young kids, I guess, that move here, I'm like, God, you're so lucky you have me. Because let me tell you what don't do and what to do.
Totally.
You know, because we had to go through it.
Yeah, you got to learn the hard way.
The very hard way. When shortly after, when did you meet Katie? Because I feel like we've known each other forever.
I met Katie right after my first album came out. So it finally came out, and it was like a weird time in the industry, kind of in between Tower Records and iTunes, you know? And so,
Napster and things.
Yeah. And so it was like number one on Yahoo, and everyone was like, great. What does that mean?
Right.
What do we do with that? You know? Right. But so I had kind of spent it by this point, it had been several years. I think I was 19 or something when I met her. And I ran out of money. I spent my whole advance. I didn't understand that when you get a record deal advance, that that's supposed to pay for the album. I was like, right. Oh, I thought you just like gave me all this money just because I'm
then,
so talented
like,
and cool.
The album comes magically, right?
Yeah. I didn't understand what it was.
Right.
And so I ran out of money because I was just like, I had an apartment in LA. I had an apartment in New York. I was like a child. I had no idea how money worked.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm rich forever.
Yeah.
And I had a spending problem for sure, which is something I probably still struggle with. But,
right.
And so I was selling my clothes at Wasteland.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's
I went to this thrift store on Melrose called Wasteland. Yeah. And I was standing in line. It's like it was very snooty, and they would like turn away. You're like, designer stuff
and you're
just
like,
be like
nah.
And it, you know, so there's like a whole line of hipsters sitting there like waiting to sell their stuff, and you go up and it's like you have a whole audience and they'll like throw stuff in the reject bin and everyone's just like snickering. Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah, they took nothing. Yeah. Like a few one top.
Yeah, exactly.
$12.
Yeah. So I was selling my clothes and Katie was there and she
wanted them.
And she came up to me and was like, you're Bonnie McKee. Like, I love your album much. And she's like, I'm an artist too. And I was like, wow, really? Like, I had never met anybody my age.
Yeah.
Much less someone that like had kind of similar style and was into the same stuff. And she's like, yeah, I just, you know, I have a record deal too. And this is before she had gotten dropped.
Yeah.
And I was like, great, let's be friends.
Is this with Sony maybe?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so we were fast friends and we started, you know, I was always having like barbecue parties. By this point, I had made some friends because I was so desperate and lonely and didn't have anyone my age. I took some night classes at UCLA because I was like, there's going to be people there. And I met some friends. And so I finally had some friends. And so I would host barbecue, you know, lots of day drinking.
Yeah.
And Katie started hanging out. And turns out, you know, I went on her MySpace. RIP MySpace, by the way. Can we please get that back?
Right?
I miss it. What a friendly, wonderful place that
I
was.
Know. It
oh,
was
my
so
God.
Nice.
It was so great. You could, like, design your own website, essentially.
Oh, I did. I learned all that coding, too.
Oh, my God. It was so amazing.
Yeah.
I really miss it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I went and listened to her stuff on MySpace and was like, wow, like, this girl's really good. And then she's like, I got dropped. And I was like, oh, like, the horror.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the beginning, I thought that, like, if you get dropped, you're done forever.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that that's really a rite of passage.
Kind of. You know, I think that it goes different ways for different people because, you know, even like I remember when Firas got dropped, or even when Katie did get dropped, they held her record for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or what happened with JoJo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes that it can be a blessing in disguise because like, well, if you're not into me, then let me go.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, please.
Yeah.
Like, I need someone that's going to like ride or die with me right now. But, you know, in Katie's case, I think, yes, it was obviously a blessing because hello.
Yeah.
And luckily they didn't shelve her too long. And luckily there was Angelica that was an angel and ended up taking her stuff over to Capitol. But that's how these things work. People don't really understand. Like, you might have a president of a record label love you, sign you, want you, and 6 months later, the powers that be decide that they're no longer working or we're going to move them over to RCA or whatever other label there is. Mm-hmm. And then they get a whole new team.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, I didn't really sign
yeah.
you.
Yeah, they don't
and
feel invested
not,
in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you're not my artist. Mm-hmm. And they either you're already hot on the label, so they can't drop you. Or you've done nothing and they're like, let's get rid of all the old stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah, and that was exactly what happened to me where I was signed by the CEO at the time. And it was like, he had just come over to Warner Brothers and taken over. So it was like a big signing.
Yeah.
And it was like on the cover of like A&R magazine. And like, mm-hmm. you know, I was like an industry darling for a second.
Yeah.
And then when the album flopped, essentially, they were like, well, we've already spent so much money on this. And like, they didn't want to let me go. So they held me hostage for years. And I was they were like, time to write.
Yeah.
Yeah. Time to write another album. And I was like, but the first one, like, no, nothing happened. Like, we can't give up on that.
Yeah.
Those were the first songs I had written. And I also was like, so precious.
Yeah.
Where I was like, what do you mean write new songs?
Give it a
like,
real
what
chance.
About all of these? Yeah.
Yeah.
But now I understand that it's like, you know, you have to be prolific. And you have to just keep creating and keep creating. And I think that in my head, also because that first album, which is very dark, and I'm really, like, I'm not very proud of it because it's some of my earliest songwriting.
Yeah.
And so it's not the best songs, but it was deeply personal and all about my traumas in Seattle and all of these things that happened to me. And so letting go of that was really, really difficult
like
for me.
Your first baby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, but I was like, okay, fine. So I started writing new songs and then no one would answer the phone at the label. Like they just had given up on me and I was difficult. I mean, to be fair, I was like a full-blown alcoholic drug addict still. Right. And so I was a pain in the ass.
You're in the storm of it.
Yeah. And so I was definitely a pain in the ass and I understand why they weren't answering my calls.
Well, still a little rude.
Yeah, but...
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get
like,
it.
Then give me guidance or something. Mm-hmm. Like, we're invested in each other.
Yeah.
You know, I remember... This is a way different story, just more sad. But I got signed here at Abrams Artists. Mm-hmm. And it was really funny because the sides they gave me was some from Clueless, which I know, like, the back of my hand.
Right.
They're like, do you need time? I'm all, yeah. And I just waited out in the hallway and just, like, twiddled my thumbs and came back in and murdered it. They signed me and then, but no one would ever answer my calls there. Right. And I'd be like, hi, can I speak to Brad? And they're like, are you signed with us? I'm all, yes.
Oh no, my God.
Brad. And like, I think it's a kind of its own thing. If you get signed by a big agency, it's mm-hmm. kind of better to get signed by a smaller agency that would love you if you haven't done anything.
Yeah.
In my instance, it was that, and they completely ignored me, and it was sad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're calling your agency. And
So I'm calling the label. I'm like, okay, I have this new stuff, da-da-da-da. No one would answer my phone calls, and I was pissed. And so I was like, well, if they're not going to help me and if they're not even going to listen to this new music, then, like, please just drop me. Like, let me go so I can go somewhere else, even though I thought in my mind that would be the end for me. But I was like, I can't just stay here and do nothing.
Right.
And so I just made a TikTok about this that went viral, but I burned a CD of what I thought were my best new songs. And I went down to like a smoke shop on Hollywood Boulevard and I bought a dagger that was like had a tiger on the handle and like a jewel for an eye. And I went to the CEO's house in the middle of the night, which was right there on Sunset. It was like an iconic house. He had lots of parties, so I knew where he lived. And there was a tree right in front of his front door. And so I stabbed the CD into the tree. And then I wrote in lipstick on his car, Platinum Baby, with like a kiss and a heart.
Uh-huh.
And because I was like, I mean, it'll do something.
Right.
It'll get a reaction.
Yeah.
He'll either hear it, be like, oh, this girl is bold and I'm going to listen to it. And yay. And then we'll live happily ever after. Or you'll let me go finally.
Yeah.
And so they dropped me. And I guess the next day was his kid's first day of school and like everyone came out and was crying hysterically and they were like afraid. I was like, I mean, I put a kiss on a heart. Like,
yeah. It sent it with love.
Yeah.
And the dagger was just keeping it in place.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how else am I going to attach it to a tree? So, yeah. So that was like my legendary story that I don't think I would do again. But you know what? That was the place I was at.
Totally.
I was at my breaking point.
Yeah.
And like, I'm pretty patient and I had waited and worked really hard. But when I reached my breaking point, like, you don't want to fuck with me.
Yeah. I'm very much like that too. I'm like, I'll get a reaction.
Yeah.
For sure. And I think that's kind of like, Katie's like that definitely.
Yeah.
So I remember when we met, kind of, I think we've kind of been in the same circle. I remember going to your house, like Taylor Russell was there. Like, there's always people that I knew. We had mutual friends. We went out for New Year's. Mm-hmm. You're infamous. You can do the splits in high heels. You can do it all. I was always like in awe by you. I was like, she's such a rock star.
Thank you. Well, I felt the same way about you.
No way.
Yes.
Oh, thanks. Honestly, I was like, Bonnie's coming. Let's go. So then you're now with, are you with another label at the time when you start working with Katie
on a professional No, label? I got dropped. I spiraled big time and was like, okay, now what? I actually went to a Vedic astrologer and was like, what the hell am I going to do? Do I have to move back to Seattle and like get a retail job? I don't know what I'm going to do. And he just said, pen to paper, just write. And I was like, how's that going to help me be a star?
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay. So I met a boy, a producer, Oliver, we were together for 8 years. He's an incredible producer.
And you're not sober at this point.
Right? I was not sober yet, no. And I was singing demos for money. And he was like writing songs for other people. And I was like, oh, that's a thing. And then his friend Josh Abraham was starting a boutique publishing company. And so I was like, I can write. I know how to write. Yeah. And they were like, whatever. I was kind of like annoying kid sister. And then I was like, look. And they finally
got all these songs.
Yeah, they finally signed me. Got a tiny little deal. There was only like 3 clients at the publishing company at the time. It's now got, 100 people signed there. Wow. And I just started writing for people and I started getting cuts, like small ones.
Yeah.
But it felt really good to be like, oh, wow. Like
how does that work exactly? So you're like, is it just different every time you go into a writing session? Like, is it you and like the artist? Are you can sometimes keep in mind of what you think and then submit your...
Yeah. So sometimes I go in with artists. I prefer to go in with artists because then you can hear from the horse's mouth what they want to say and what they want to sound like. And then other times you write songs with other writers and producers and then you pitch them. So your publisher is kind of like an agent for songwriters where they are the liaison between you and the artist and the label. And so they know everyone at the labels and then they take your songs around and go, oh, like whatever, Jennifer Lopez is looking for something or this person's looking for something. And they'll tell you ahead of time, like, we're looking for something in this vein, write something like we want a female empowerment song, whatever it is. And then they make it happen.
Was that like also giving you a lot of anxiety? Because it's almost like having the golden ticket if you know that Jennifer Lopez or someone like that has one of your songs. They've got plenty of songs to pick from, but they have it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the big deal, right? That's getting your foot in the door.
Yeah.
So you just be like, did she love it or did she not?
The other thing is like a lot of times songs will get cut by big artists and then they don't come out.
Them.
Yeah. So they'll hold the songs hostage sometimes. And so you can't pitch it to anybody else. And then they'll just be like, never mind. And then by the time that's happened, then it's like the song is no
longer. Yeah, I've heard I don't know how, maybe through friends, but I've heard a few cuts that was like, it was Pussycat Dolls and it was Rihanna. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else all on this one song and they all sounded amazing. Mm-hmm. And then one was picked for a movie. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, wow. But, because usually I would think if like, say Rihanna did it, be like, this is my song.
Right.
Maybe it was a different time. And now she's like, no, I'm on the
track.
But yeah, that's funny how that works.
Yeah.
So you're writing songs and is it then Katie calls you?
Because
Katie took a minute to hit, actually.
Yeah.
Like we didn't know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think she came out after Firas came out, and he did okay, and then they started with "You're So Gay," and then "I Kissed a Girl," and then is it the next album?
Yeah. So Katie blew up,
yeah,
and it was so exciting to have someone like kind of in my circle where it's working for them.
Yeah, all of us.
Of course, I was like insanely jealous because that was all I wanted and I was still stuck at, I just gotten dropped, whatever. But,
because it's like, and I've been thinking about this a lot and I tell people that there's not one formula. And when I was talking to the producers about you coming on, I was like, Bonnie, one, you're just a star. And that you can have everything all lined up, all into place. Because I'll tell you what, Dr. Luke once asked me about Kesha's releasing TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
Is it TikTok?
Yeah.
I get it mixed up with TikTok. And so, but I had loved all of, we've known Kesha for a while. But I remember I loved her previous stuff so much that I was hooked on that. So that was just a new song. And I was like, no, not this one. And I had loved another one. But, you know, you just never know because it was number one. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I don't know anything. You know, but I did love I Kissed a Girl. And I do love songs that are hits. But then you just really never know you what's going to hit.
Yeah.
And like even with Katie, like the label didn't want that to be a single. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it just was. And then it hits. Now she's popular. She calls you. And now you guys started off with California Girl.
That was the first single, but that wasn't the first song that we wrote together.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I was getting some cuts around town. And so Dr. Luke called me and was interested in signing me. Of course, I already had this other publishing deal, but because it was such a small label or whatever, they were like, let's just do a joint venture. So I ended up signing to both of them. So I have two publishers. And he said, you know, I want you to work on this Katie album. And at the time, Katie and I were like kind of had a falling out and we were like, I was jealous and we were whatever. We had just like, we're having some girl problems.
Yeah, I've been there.
And so he was like, I want you to work on the Katie album. And I was like, I don't wanna. Like, because he was also signing me as an artist. And I was like, I just want to focus on my stuff, da-da-da. And I know she didn't want me there.
Yeah.
And she was like, anyone else, anyone but her. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you guys are working together and that's that.
Love it.
And so we got in the studio and it was magic.
It worked.
It worked. The first song that we wrote together was Part of Me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I was so broke. Oh my God, I was so broke. And I was like, I really need this. And I just remember I didn't have a car. Like
my not broke because of Part of Me. Broke.
No, I was broke. Broke.
Yeah.
Like I didn't have hot water. My hot water was getting turned off. My cell phone would get turned off. Yeah. I didn't have a car. Like it was bad. Yeah. I was like scrounging through the couch for change to eat Taco Bell. That was my life. So I remember they drove me up to they were recording in Santa Barbara and I went up and when I got there, my cell phone had been turned off. And so I was like wandering around the Four Seasons, like I can't exactly ask them, where's Katy Perry?
Yeah.
Like they're not going to take me to a room, you know? Right. And I just luckily like ran into Luke and was like, help, I'm lost. Oh, and I remember like getting in this big luxurious bathtub with all these fancy soaps and hot water and just like sobbing tears of joy and just being like, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah, I feel
and so,
safe.
Yes.
I feel safe here.
So I'm forever grateful to Katie and Luke for giving me a chance, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's just part of all of our journeys that we're a part of each other's life. And I think, you know, we're here to be guides, teachers, and even in the most negative way, you know, when people kind of fuck you over, you just kind of take that moment to learn from them. And, you know, no matter what you guys had going on, even in that very moment, when you came together, you created something so magical.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, this is what it was all for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to go through that struggle. You had to go through, I mean, because Katie's been there as well.
Yeah.
You know, I remember her cell phone getting turned off. Her car was going to be repossessed.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her with her bag of clothes on Vine Street. And she goes, oh my God, you saw me? And I was like, yeah, I was wondering if I should stop, but you seemed okay. And I was in a rush. You know, and I've definitely been there throughout the times of, you know, getting my car repossessed. And as awful as those moments were, I mean, they attribute to our story.
Absolutely. You know? And I'm so grateful for those times too, because I, you know, because I was signed so young and I had people taking care of me or whatever, I had business managers and whatever, all of a sudden it was just me. I had to learn how to pay my taxes. I had to learn how to have a budget. I had to learn, you know, how to get car insurance, how to get health insurance. I remember struggling to get health insurance because I had been taking antidepressants and I was like, oh my God, like, they're like, oh, you have a pre-existing condition. I was like, so you can, what the, like, I'm taking antidepressants like everyone else in the world.
Yeah.
It was important for me to learn how the world works, you know? And I'm really grateful.
It's an obstacle course.
Yeah, I'm like, grateful for those years, honestly. Yeah,
definitely. So what happens when California Girl hits and it's a success? Is it your phone blowing up?
I mean,
everybody wants a
piece of you. It was hard to believe. because it had been so many years of struggling and poverty and just like heartbreak. And so when it hit, I really kind of had imposter syndrome because, of course, it was a hit. I was in with Max Martin and Dr. Luke and Katy Perry, like the biggest people in the world on the planet.
In that moment,
like, of course it was a hit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when everyone could congratulate me, I'd be like, I don't feel like I did anything. I don't feel like I did anything. But then, you know, as the years went on, I was like, no, I...
You had to step into your place.
Yeah. I contributed a lot to this. Yeah. And it wouldn't be what it was. It may have been a hit, but it wouldn't be what it ended up being without my contribution, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm really proud of the work that I've done.
Of course. It's major.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. what happens then after?
I moved out of my piece of shit apartment in Hollywood and, I rented a house in Hollywood at Lake Hollywood. I found it on Westside Rentals and I was like looking for a house to buy. Like I got my first check and was like, okay, I guess it's time to buy a house, you know? And I was like house hunting, but I was staying in this amazing house. And I was like, I don't know. I don't think anything's better than this. Like there are more modern houses. There are more, you know, like, should I have a mansion? Like, I don't know. What do I do with this money? I still like, I've never had that, been responsible with money in my life at that point. And I just fell in love with this house and I ended up asking the owners if I could buy it and they sold it to me. They were the original owners. They got married in the backyard.
And that's the house whole you have thing. Now.
Yes.
Oh my God. You have an amazing house.
Thank with you.
This incredible view.
Thank you. Yeah. It's very like Boogie Nights, kind of like Brady Bunch style, which is my favorite. And it's not like the most modern house or anything like that. It's not super everything. Fancy, but it's just like, it's got a nice homey feel really and like fancy. Really good vibes to it. So that was like, that's still to this day. I'm like, my biggest accomplishment is owning this house.
Getting a house. Yeah. I mean, definitely from, you know, where we kind of grew up and came from and that struggle that is so very real to have a permanent place to lay your head down, like means the world. I mean, I still wake up every day and I look up and I say thank you
that
even when I go to bed because I have like a safe place to rest my head. I had an anxiety nightmare like 3 nights ago and I was back at my first apartment.
Oh no.
I know. On Whitley and Franklin and they hadn't changed a thing and the carpet was disgusting and I had some of my stuff now moved there and I didn't understand why I was back and like the markings on the wall were still there and the walls were dirty and it was like and I was like shaking and like why am I back here when I woke up and I was like oh it's just a dream. I'm so grateful.
What a relief.
No yeah definitely. So now you have some hit songs. Mm-hmm. When does sobriety come in for you?
Well, you know, when I, so I had already been through a lot and, and when I was signing my deal with Luke and things were happening with Katy and Max Martin and all these, the stakes were really high. I had a couple of times during that process that I was like, I probably shouldn't be drunk or hungover in this situation.
Right.
Like I'm getting a second chance.
Right.
And most people don't get a second chance. Not like this.
I mean, but even for you to have that awareness, you're so far ahead of a lot of people that...
Well, I mean, I had had so many rock bottoms
in
my, you know, decade of drinking at that point or more that I was like, how do I need for it to get that bad?
Yeah.
Do I need to end up in rehab? Do I need to get in a car accident? Do I need, you know, like I have something good. I don't want to fuck this up. I got to have my head on straight.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting in a program and I've been sober for almost 11 years, God willing. Wow. February, it'll be 11 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's such an amazing thing. And I'll tell you why it's so amazing because you're in a world that tells you to celebrate drinking, to cover your sorrows in drinking. I mean, you're in the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. It's all about drinking.
Escapism.
Yeah. Escapism. Yeah. And, I think, that's really commendable for you to have 11 years is like, wow. I mean, every day is a wow, right?
Yes.
Because every day it starts and that's like the struggle.
Yeah. And even if I have a bad day, I can go to bed knowing that I didn't drink that day.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've accomplished something.
Definitely. You know? And you got through that.
Mm-hmm.
How important now is it for you to stay sober and keep your circle around people that support
that? Oh my gosh. It's everything to me. It's a spiritual practice. It's a beautiful community. And I do feel like, you know, when I am working on myself, it's really like a blueprint for how to not be an asshole.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are many different 12-step programs that people can use that aren't alcohol related. And it's just a great way to be a better person and to look at your character flaws and correct them. So I'm always at risk. Yeah. I'm always at risk of slipping back into bad habits. Mm-hmm. So it's important for me to stay connected. And I honestly love it. It doesn't feel like a chore. It doesn't feel like, oh, I got to go to meeting.
No, because you know how you're going to feel. And I think when you have, again, that awareness, you know what that other road's going to lead to.
Yeah.
Like, it's just one way.
Yes.
And, but, you know, to choose sobriety and to choose yourself first is an adventure. That's the adventure because you don't know where that's going to go. Mm-hmm. And that's only going to go to like bright, fun, great, finding yourself in different ways. And I mean that, like, you're going to be aware of those moments that you have where instead of like, oh, I went on this really cool trip, I drank the entire time, I don't remember it.
Yeah.
You know, so like you're not really on an adventure or something that's going to grow you in a positive way.
Well, the other thing is like when, you know, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. No, like bad things still happen, obviously. Yeah. But it's so much better and it's so much easier to cope.
Yeah.
To get through it, to recover.
Than keeping yourself down and down and down.
Yeah,
and down.
Because it's like easy to drink at something or drink at someone.
Yeah.
And when I don't, when I remove that option, then I just kind of have to sit in my feelings and face them and deal with them, and they go away quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't further fuck things up. Right. You know, which is what I used to do.
Yeah.
Just sabotage, just destroy.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely in our group, I could say we've all been there and we've all like gone down that path in one way or another. Or had friends that go down that path. Did you find it hard to then keep relationships, and how supportive were friends in that moment?
I had a group
throughout the years.
I had a group of girlfriends that were kind of my drinking buddies that are not in the industry or anything, and things definitely shifted because I got sober. They didn't. I was starting to have success. They were in the same place. And all of a sudden, I was like, we don't really have that much in common anymore. And I think there was some jealousy and some competitiveness, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And so I ended up kind of breaking up with some girlfriends of mine. That was devastating. Like, I still get triggered.
Yeah.
If I see them out, I just kind of never got over it. But and I do miss them as people, but it was just something that needed to happen. And
once again, choosing, you have to choose yourself to survive, you know?
Yeah.
And that's so important. Like, I mean, I always often have to make those choices myself, being in the restaurant nightclub industry. And a lot of nights I choose not to drink, and not that for me, at least I believe it's not a problem. And I know what, like you said, these big opportunities are coming.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that this might be a party tonight, but I've got to be in the office tomorrow.
Yeah.
I've got openings. I've got production meetings. And I want to be present for them because I want to show up for the people that are showing up for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I decide to make those decisions and those choices.
And I think also the older I got, because I was 28 when I got sober. And, like, even just having a couple glasses of wine, I felt it the next day.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah. And because I can't guarantee that I'm only going to have two glasses of wine, I really, once I have one, you know, my inhibitions are out the window and I can't really control myself. And I was like, I can't afford to have a crazy night where I'm, like, throwing up or pissing people off or whatever the hell it is, you know?
Right.
And so I think also just physically I was like, I don't think I can handle this. I would also just, like, wake up with anxiety. Like, I would just... Even if nothing weird had happened, I just went to dinner and had some wine. I would wake up and be like, what did I say? What did I do? Who did I piss off? Did I text somebody? Did I, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know. I know. Like, I know exactly what I said. I know exactly
everything.
Who I talked to.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about things just disappearing from my memory. You know, it's really amazing. I feel like I have a superpower sometimes.
Totally. You know? Like in the room, you're like, I'm going to remember this. And, you know, I often get that too, where people are just like repeating themselves. It's like that repetitive drunk moment.
Yeah, the loop. Yeah.
This story. I got to get out of here. So how has being sober, because before in the past, I'm sure. Well, yeah. So you weren't writing sober before, but how is it different writing sober now?
Oh, yeah. I was really afraid that when I got sober that I would just be boring.
Yeah.
That I would just suddenly have nothing to say and all my creativity would be gone. But, like, honestly, I have so many years of, like, trauma and, like, crazy experiences from being an alcoholic and a drug addict. Like, I don't need...
I mean, that's all about you, you know, obviously. But
like... I have a whole well of emotion to pull from.
Yeah.
I have a lifetime of that.
Yeah.
I don't need to live it.
Yeah.
To
and throw yourself pull from in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And destroy and yourself. Be inspired by it, you know?
Right.
And also I'm just way more efficient, you know, like before I would get writer's block and I would go to the bar next door and I would just be like crying at the bar, you know, I'm a sloppy mess.
Yeah.
And I didn't get that much done. I mean, I worked really hard all the time, but I was just, my health was suffering and I don't feel like my work was that great. So now I don't know, I feel a lot more inspired being able to wake up and just be present.
Yeah.
And also, like, it's an emotional experience getting sober. There's a lot to pull from.
Yeah.
Like, you're facing things you didn't really think you'd ever
have.
You
numbed yourself before.
Yeah. So there's a lot to draw from. And there's also a lot of beautiful things that you get out of it. And the community and the friends and the relationships and, you know, like, not to be TMI or whatever, but, like, having sex sober for the first time was, like, so terrifying. And you really have to learn to be vulnerable and, like, be honest. There's a lot. It's a wealth of inspiration. Yeah.
No, I think that does strengthen you because, you know, when you're being intimate with someone, the first thing you kind of think of is, like, where's the wine or where's the vodka? Yeah. Like, let's do a shot, you know, before we get into this and turn off the lights.
There's definitely nothing boring about being sober. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
It's like...
constant adventure.
Yeah, for sure. Having to feel every single feeling.
Yeah.
Like, that's the most punk rock thing you can do.
I think I'm lucky because, you know, I live with August Getty, and he, tomorrow is 1 year of sobriety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I definitely know the road for him was, it needs to be sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people need that to happen. And so I try to be as supportive as I can. And for me, I enjoy not drinking with him.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy the new things that we get to do.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy his enthusiasm about, like, oh my God, I can't wait to travel and, like, not just get drunk at the hotel room of whatever country we're in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those kind of, it is a new adventure and it is adventure every time. And
good, clean fun.
Yeah. And he's constantly finding things for us to do. Like, now we do Spartan races,
mm-hmm.
which I enjoy so much, and I've gotten addicted to, or you find a dog, or lots of things. You get into, he's learning Italian, and I love watching all of this, and it is a whole new world because, not that we're just only making this about drinking, but it is that, you know, it is important, I think, to tell people and show people the options of what's out there, and for me, you've always kind of, like, I barely remember the moments of being drunk with you. I mean, we definitely had our times at Teddy's.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely had the times I would tell people, I go, when Kesha says taking drinks off the bar, that was real.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't have any money. We would just go in.
Yep.
Or we have, like, our own flasks or something like that. Do those years seem, because they seem like a long time ago, but also I remember them.
Yeah.
No, I remember the moment.
It seems like a totally different life
to me. I mean, there were the moments where I think about, you know, the moments of, like, being at James Valentine's house and it'd be like you and Katie and maybe like a Rob Pattinson in the day and, like, someone brings out a guitar. I don't know if those moments happen a lot anymore where, like, artists kind of come together. You're like, it does for me every day. Right? It's called the writer's room.
No. I mean, like, yeah, of course that's my job.
Yeah.
But it's not like a party environment.
Not like a kumbaya moment.
Yeah. I think that's also, like, you know, when you're young and new to it all, you know. But I don't know. I don't get out much, honestly. I'm just, honestly, since the pandemic, especially, I've been so kind of a hermit. I've just really been like doing a lot of work on myself and creating and thinking about my path forward and what I want to do next. I made a short film in the pandemic.
Yeah.
And that was
April Kills the Vibe.
April Kills the Vibe, yeah, which it's not available to the public because it was in the film festival circuit, but I just did my last film festival because it's like a 2-year window where it's like you can submit your stuff.
So tell me the starting process of wanting to do, because you're an amazing actress.
Thank you.
And that's another thing like people should know, like,
thank you.
No, you did like that wonderful film with Robin Williams and
yeah,
it was a while ago, but I mean, you're a star.
Thank you.
And I'm so happy that you're back using this medium as well, because, you know, like, there's not, you don't have to be stuck in one thing. You don't have to just be a songwriter or just this, because that's why I love Salvador Dali so much, because he was a painter, sculptor. He directed his own things. Like, you know, it's across the board. Once you're creative, you're creative. Mm-hmm. So use any outlet.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, I think that I kind of had blinders on for so long because, like, being a songwriter and being a singer had been, since I was 16 years old. That was how I ate.
Yeah.
But I was kind of feeling unfulfilled for a second and was just like, what else do I have in me? And I think that a lot of us in the pandemic really took a look at our lives and was like, what really makes me happy?
Hopefully.
And
I think you went one way or the other.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. and when I thought about when I was happiest, I love being on set. I love music videos. I feel like that's why I started writing music, was because I wanted to. I remember growing up watching Michael Jackson and Madonna and Prince and being like, or like seeing Britney Spears on TRL after school and being like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
I want to play a character. I want to dance. I want to sing. I want to wear costumes. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll make a visual album, da da da. But then I was like, I don't know. I kind of want to tell a longer story than 3.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to just make a scene for my acting reel just to like, because I don't have that much to work with.
Right.
But all of the scenes that my acting coach had sent me, I was like, these are cool, but I don't really feel like it's showing my range. Also, it requires me finding another actor in the middle of a pandemic. I'm just going to write my own thing.
This was done during the pandemic?
This was in 2020.
Oh, girl, this is really good.
Like, thank you.
Because I was like, this is so beautifully shot. It's so,
thank you.
And I watched it and I told you that, you know, it made me feel a type of way and I connected to it. But I didn't know, I mean, that's even harder to do.
Well, yeah. So I was like, I'm just going to write my own scene. And then I just kept writing and was like, I feel like this is kind of a standalone piece. So I was like, okay, well, who am I going to hire? How am I going to find an actress? And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to play both parts.
And you did it so well.
Thank you.
Yeah, you really did.
So I threw on a couple of wigs.
Yeah.
And some contacts. And it was really, really fun. And I was like, oh, this will just show my range. But I didn't have any expectations. I was like, this will just be a cool thing for YouTube or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I wrote it. I directed it. I starred in it, played two characters. And
so
I
much
scored
work,
it.
By the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then I was like, maybe I'll try to get into a film festival. Like, who knows? And then there's a website called Film Freeway where you can submit to pretty much every film festival on the planet. And so I submitted it, and I ended up getting into a bunch of festivals, and I won 53 awards.
Wow.
And I was shook.
Oh, shook, for sure.
I mean, I think that, you know, it's kind of a cheating because I played two different roles, and so I think that's kind of like the novelty of it all, that white people were like, wow. And the fact that I made it in the pandemic.
I don't think it's cheating. It's really just kind of like showing, you know, your creative range, your acting range, that you even took it upon yourself, because these kind of things are scary. If you're like, I don't have another actor, I'm just not going to do that. I'll shelve this project for a while. Maybe when we get back, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. But you just went ahead and did it.
I just did it.
Yeah.
I just did it.
I think that's like, it speaks highly of you. And like what you said too, like, spoke to me, like either, like looking back during the pandemic and sitting with yourself for so long, I mean, that's what created my change. Like, that's how I ended up losing 100 pounds. And it wasn't even about the weight loss. It was, I sat with myself and I realized my phone wasn't going off. And I was like, wait, what makes you really happy?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how my transition started.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how me wanting to do this. And I wanted to be on set. And I got a phone call from Kate Beckinsale. I was like, and this is all like me just putting my foot out there and me just starting to and me putting it into the universe, it'll call back. Mm-hmm. And Kate's like, do you want to audition? And I was like, yes. And I also said I was going to say yes. And if it scared me, I was going to run towards it.
Right.
You know, and when the producers for this, for Marsha came to me, they said, have you ever thought about having a podcast? I go, every day. And they're like, do you want one? I go, mm-hmm. And my partner John's like, that was so strange. And then you just walked out. And then the next day there was producers. And I was like, oh, shit, this is real.
Wow.
Now I'm going to have to, like, work at it to make mm-hmm. it happen. But I'm going to step up and I'm just going to show up and see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, and that goes to show of, like, showing up and doing the project that you love and things that spoke to you that made you happy. Mm-hmm. You know, I also got into martial arts again because that's something I did as a kid. Mm-hmm. And that I remember being very happy then. Mm-hmm. Acting is something I did as a kid. Mm-hmm. I remember being very happy, mm-hmm. you know, and without needing a lot of people. And that mm-hmm. those things kind of like are on your own road. Which is super special to have because, like you said, you turn into a hermit. Like, I can definitely go into that space mm-hmm. and be okay with myself. Living with yourself and being able to be alone with yourself, I think, is something very special.
I really yeah. need it.
I need I'm it now, too.
I'm just one of those people where I need space
yeah.
or my brain gets really overloaded. Yeah. I need time to just, like, let the aliens talk to me or whatever. Yeah. Or nothing will come to me
yeah.
if I don't have quiet, peace and quiet. Like when I'm in the car, don't listen to the radio, don't listen to anything. I yeah. just want quiet. And if I don't get that, I start to kind of unravel.
Yeah.
So I have to really make time in my schedule to be alone and to be quiet and to be still.
Yeah, I do that now. And I mean, it's harder and I knew it would be. And I knew that during my moment, during the pandemic, I didn't know how long it was going to last. I didn't know what it was, but I know that I've been the poorest of poor, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's nothing that can affect me more than that, you know? So there's no reason why we don't take these shots.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
there's no reason why we don't say yes to things because what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
Doesn't work out? Well, I've been there before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and... it makes me really happy that, you know, you've kind of had that great awareness of, because I think it is that it's what makes you happy as a child, mm-hmm. what made you at a very young age want to pursue the singing, the song. I mean, obviously there was an escape part from, mm-hmm. you know, the hard life you mm-hmm. had before. But what's coming up next for Bonnie McKean?
Well, I have like 2 albums worth of material. And so I've been trying to figure out what the best way to put that out is. When I was signed, so I ended up, once I had all of these hits with Katie and Britney Spears and whoever, I ended up
major
signing another major record deal.
Are you with your first publication or?
My publisher, yeah.
Publisher,
I'm still with my publishers.
Yeah, okay.
And so I signed a record deal as an artist. I put out American Girl, which did pretty well, but you know, it's hard, like having so much like astronomical success as a songwriter,
yeah.
working with Katie, the biggest pop stars in the world. And then I put out my thing. And if I were just like Jane Doe that came from Oklahoma and like ended up at 23 on the chart, people would be like, wow. But because everyone's used to seeing me at number one all the time, yeah. it's like, it flopped. You know?
You're like, no, that's not exactly what happened.
Yeah. It's so hard right. to like live in the shadow of my own work.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, I see that.
So I recorded and wrote a whole album while I was signed to Epic and I toured with it, but Epic didn't see eye to eye with me. And so I was like, I want out of here. I'm not going to be held hostage again. I've done yeah. this before.
Scatter,
so I was like, let me out of here. But they still own the masters. And
I've got plenty of knives.
Yeah, look out. Yeah. I'm coming with my tiger dagger.
The trees.
And so when I got on TikTok, I guess, what, a year and a half ago now, the fans kept asking for these songs from that era. And they've been leaking the demos. They've gotten tattoos of the lyrics. They make fake wow. artwork for it. And I was like, you know, I was always so heartbroken that I never got to put that album out. And I was like, you know what? Like, why not? Like, everyone is nostalgic for the 2010s pop.
Yeah.
Why not? So I've been negotiating with Sony to get this master's back, which has been a whole nightmare. But I re-recorded a lot of it and I made a music video and I'm like, I'm just going to give the people what they want because it's about closing a chapter for me too, because this is like the album that never was that I worked so hard on and really believed in was at the top of my songwriting game. And so that is going to be my next release.
Oh, wow,
and then I also have an entire other album that is from like the beginning of the pandemic that I'm really excited about, but I just wanted to put out the old stuff first because like I want things to go in chronological order.
Right.
So yeah. And now that I mean, you know, I'm not huge on TikTok or anything, but I've seen my friends like blow up and have like real success in the music industry, have tours and play Lollapalooza and get played on the radio and all that stuff. And I'm like, this is such a democratic thing for artists to really like, it's really up to you.
Yeah. And what you want to do with these new social mediums that we didn't really have before at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, it used to be you had to have a record deal or you didn't exist.
And you couldn't survive.
Yeah. And so now, you know, the power is back in the artist's hands. Yeah. And I'm just really grateful for that. And I love getting like immediate feedback from my fan base. And I can have whole conversations with them. It's just, I really love it. I'm a big fan. And I really like fought it for a while where I was like, I'm too old for TikTok. And like, I don't want to dance in my living room and be an idiot, whatever. Right. But
there's so many other things.
Oh, my gosh. I learned so much and I connect with so many people. And I don't know. I really love it. And it's been a lot. And I get to do like little kind of mini movies and skits and stuff, which is like, I guess you use that part of my brain.
I want to be in one of your movies.
Oh, my God. Let's do it.
Yeah. Let's do something like that. Is there any acting or writing, directing that you want to do?
Well, April Kills the Vibe is kind of a scene from a bigger project that I am working on. I wrote a pilot for sort of a music industry based series. So that's, and I'm just dipping my toe into that world. It's like, it moves a lot slower than the music industry.
So slow.
But I don't know. I've gotten some good feedback and I'm hoping that I can have a full ass TV show. Like that's the plan where I could write all my own music for it. And it's kind of based on my story and my experiences, but with a twist. So, that's kind of what's next for me.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I can't wait. And I can't wait to, hear the new music. Wait. I actually wanted to know what the deal was with re-recording. So like the record label owns the original masters because, I mean, this happened to Taylor Swift, right?
Uh-huh.
So they own the recording session.
Yeah. They
basically.
Yes.
And then you could re-record it, and make it your own.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to completely re-record it because it was
magic
what it was.
When you did.
Yeah. And so I kept parts of it. And then I re-record. I just kind of updated the production and stuff. And so that's kind of what I'm in negotiations with Sony about. And it has been very slow and irritating. And I'm about to blow them up on TikTok about it.
Yeah. Let's let her have her music. Let's let us listen. Let's let us enjoy it. How we've enjoyed Bonnie so much. And thank you so much for coming on Marsha.
Thank you.
It's been such a pleasure, of course. I've been wanting you to come on actually and sit and speak, and I miss you so much. And you can come back again anytime you want to.
I'd love to
speak about something.
Thank you. I'm honored to be invited.
Yes.
Makes me feel like I'm in the cool kid club.
You're definitely in the club. And you're always a cool kid.
Thank you.
Yeah. I love you so much.
I love you too.
This podcast is brought to you by Vocal Podcast Network. Executive producers are Michaela Simon and Marsha Molinari. Produced by Yonta Taiwo, Morgan McDonald, and Ariana Giles. Shooting and editing by Morgan McDonald. Music by Aaron Rees. Artwork by Dominic Demetz. And hosted by Marsha Molinari. Remember to follow at Marsha Molinari and at Vocal Podcasts everywhere. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast.